spirit of reconciliation. Herbert Smith Freehills acknowledges the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea, and community. We pay our respects to their elders past and present, and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people today.
Hi everyone, I'm Michael Vrasakis, a partner in the Herbert Smith Freehills Financial Services team. Welcome to our podcast series called the FSR GPS. This series focuses on topical and emerging issues in financial services regulation, which we think are the most strategic and important issues for our clients. Feel free to suggest topics you would like us to cover in the future, but for now, we hope you enjoy today's episode.
Hi everyone, I'm Peter Jones, a partner here at Herbert Smith Freehills in our technology, media and telecommunications team. I have around about 20-odd years in advising financial services clients in relation to technology projects, and I'm also a co-chair in our firm's Global Bank Sector Group, and very much looking forward to spending some time with you today.
And hi, I'm Susanna Wilkinson. I'm the regional head of HSF's Emerging Technology Group for the APAC region, so which is focusing on advising clients on the adoption of key emerging technologies.
Hi, I'm Angelica Bayliss. I'm a senior associate within the financial services regulatory team at HSF, with a focus on the banking and financial services sectors, fintech and payments, non-bank lending, and anti-money laundering.
Hi, I'm Nan Partella, and I'm a solicitor also in the technology, media, and telecommunications team at HSF, with a specialisation in privacy and data and general commercial issues in the tech sector. In this episode of the FSR GPS podcast series, we'll be looking at a slightly different topic, which is the impact of quantum computing on the financial services sector. We're going to explore what quantum computers are, some of their potential use cases in the financial services sector, and some of the security and legal risks that they pose. So, what is a quantum computer?
Nan, let me jump in there. So quantum computing technically is a multidisciplinary field comprising aspects of computer science, physics and maths. It uses quantum mechanics to solve highly complex problems that would be outside the reach of classical computers. So a powerful quantum computer could solve problems in hours that would take classical computers or even supercomputers years to solve. So how does it do this? Well, a classical computer expresses information in binary states. Think of a series of switches being either on or off. These are represented by bits, units of information, as individual electrical impulses, we know as zeros and ones. In contrast, quantum computers use qubits that can express multiple states simultaneously. Thanks to the phenomenon of superposition, quantum bits or qubits can store a zero or a one, but can also contain a zero and a one at the same time. So it's essentially a form of multidimensional storage. Now, it gets a little bit confusing, but if we oversimplify it, if you think of classical computing as a string of coins lying either heads or tails, the more coins you add, the more possible combinations of heads and tails, but there can only ever be one combination at a time. Now, if you imagine the same number of coins balancing delicately on their edges, each coin can either be heads or tails, or a probability of being either heads or tails. The analogy often used is solving a path through a maze. Classical computers must sequentially crunch through one path after another up to the maximum possible paths to find the way through. But a quantum computer, thanks to this superposition, can work out all possible paths or can test all possible paths at once and return the correct path. So in effect, the powerful potential of quantum computers is this ability to carry out multiple calculations at the same time.
How could quantum computers be used in the financial services sector?
Quantum computing potentially has huge application in financial services, and a number of large financial services institutions worldwide have already started to invest their quantum computing capabilities, including the Commonwealth Bank of Australia and JP Morgan. So one example of use cases of quantum in the financial services sector is through portfolio and trading optimization. A powerful enough quantum computer could be used to run more complex algorithms and provide more useful optimization results that take into account more variables than, say, classical computers could. So these optimization can be useful for lending, but improving the ability for banks to estimating the probability of default before they make lending decisions. Another example is in pricing financial assets. So sufficiently powerful quantum computers could simulate a larger number of possible outcomes necessary for allocating pricing with greater speed and accuracy. Quantum computing can also increase the power of AI systems used by financial services institutions in their operations. So, for example, in relation to, say, call centers or other customer engagement services.
That sounds really interesting. Thanks, Angelica. So where are we up to at the moment with the development of quantum computers?
Well, Nayan, a number of companies around the world have already started building working quantum computers, including the big players like IBM and Microsoft and so on, as well as startups like D-Wave, Quantum Brilliance and others. But it's important to note that current models of quantum computers still face numerous challenges, and they're not really powerful or stable enough yet for wide-scale commercial use. At this stage, they're useful for solving some specific types of problems, but they will increasingly become more useful for real-world problems, as they become more powerful and as the error rates start to drop. They're also just physically really large machines, and they're really expensive to buy and operate. So unsurprisingly, we're seeing quantum as a service emerge, which is effectively cloud-based quantum computing services. And this offers an exciting opportunity for developers and researchers and businesses. It gives them a platform to develop and test quantum algorithms on real quantum computers or simulators via the cloud. And I think this is an interesting area because these services will offer great access to quantum computing capabilities as the technology continues to advance, but remains too expensive for sort of wide scale own and operate.
Thanks, Isabel. So you've mentioned that current quantum computers aren't powerful enough for widespread use. When do you think we'll get to that point?
The million dollar question, Nayan. Look, there are, as I said, several challenges still facing quantum. Effectively, the power of a quantum computer lies primarily in the number of qubits that can be arranged into that quantum computer's processor. So as we add more qubits into the processor, we're able to perform more and more complex and more useful algorithms at a much greater speed. But the problem is that qubits are really sensitive to interference. When qubits are interfered with, they collapse and leave their quantum state. Quantum decoherence is that term is called. So back to the coin analogy I referred to earlier, imagine all the coins balancing delicately and then something bumps the table and all the coins fall over. So the more qubits on a processor, the harder it is to maintain their fragile quantum states. And there's a great quote that I really like by Carwell O'Connell from Cosmos magazine. And he says, a qubit is the ultimate diva. While a Hollywood starlet might demand a gigantic dressing room and a bath full of rose petals, a qubit demands perfect isolation and a thermostat set at 1/100th of a degree above absolute zero. So we're talking about minus 273 degrees Celsius. Right? The slightest vibration from a nearby atom can cause a qubit to throw a quantum tantrum and lose its superposition. So you get the idea that they're really, really sensitive, and often they're in huge fridges, so big machines. So despite all of that, there's been a lot of progress towards the development of more powerful quantum computers. IBM, for example, recently announced Condor, which is a general purpose quantum computer, and it's got 1,121 qubits, and they're planning on the release of a 4,000 qubit machine in 2025. So there's a bit of a timeline. But to put that into context, back in October 2019, Google claimed to have reached quantum supremacy. So this was a big thing that a lot of people were waiting for, which was when a quantum computer could purportedly solve a problem beyond the capabilities of a classical machine. And at that point, they only had an array of 54 qubits. So now we're talking about, you know, looking at 4,000 qubit machines. So that's a big jump. So back then, they performed a series of operations in 200 seconds that Google claimed at the time would take a supercomputer about 10,000 years to complete. Now, IBM disagreed a little bit and said that there was a better comparison in terms of the estimate of time, that it might have taken 2.5 days using techniques that maximize computing speed in a classical supercomputer. But all of that aside, where are we heading? So Google is aiming to build a useful quantum computer by 2029. And IBM's roadmap that you can see on their website shows sort of progress milestones out to about 2033. Other companies are claiming that or aiming to develop, their version earlier. Academics and industry are still, we're making strides towards building the use case for quantum computers, but it really isn't yet clear when we'll get to a point where they will be both ready and, ready for wide-scale commercial adoption and also affordable.
Thanks, Isabel. So on the more slightly concerning side, one of the hot topics in the realm of quantum computing is that quantum computers will have the ability to break modern forms of encryption. What exactly is the risk here and how will it impact our current systems?
Yeah, thanks, Nayan. And I'm not sure why, as a tech partner who's used to proselytizing new technology, I'm out here potentially looking at the negative. But nevertheless, in spite of some of the challenges that Susanna went through in terms of where we currently are with quantum computing, it's certainly the case that a sufficiently powerful quantum computer would be able to break many of the widely used public key cryptography systems commonly used today, which obviously could include those that we are used to secure communications over the internet. And of course, secure communications over the internet are crucial to our modern financial system. So this vulnerability could be severe if it was to eventuate. It is also the case that it could impact the operation of some blockchains, cryptocurrency, and crypto wallets, which make use of some of the potentially vulnerable systems and communication networks. As I mentioned at the outset, though, the biggest caveat here is that this risk will only eventuate with quantum computers that are significantly more powerful than the ones that we have today.
Thanks, Peter. So we heard earlier that we could have useful quantum computers within the decade. Does that mean that we'll also be able to break public key systems in that time as well?
Well, I think it's important here to distinguish between a useful quantum computer on the one hand, and then on the other, one which is actually powerful enough to break public key systems. Estimates for how many qubits would be required to break public key systems in a reasonable time do certainly vary, but some researchers have estimated you would need around 20 million. Clearly, based on some of the commentary that Susanna ran through before, we're a long way away from that. And so at this stage, it isn't clear when we'll actually get to the point at which we are at risk, or indeed if we ever will. But it's fair to say some estimates are also suggesting as early sometime in the 2030s. And of course, despite all of this, though, quantum computers with far fewer qubits than 20 million have already been shown to be very useful. Again, focusing here very much on the negative side of things in terms of the risk to some of the public key encryption systems that are used at the moment.
So it does sound like this is a risk that won't eventuate for a while then, if it does at all. Is this something that we need to be worried about now?
Yeah, it's a good question, Nayan. I guess, there is a risk always that data which is currently encrypted using known systems at the moment that may in the future become vulnerable. That data could, of course, can be stolen now and hoarded, and then decrypted later using sufficiently powerful quantum computers, which is called a steal now, decrypt later attack. It's not new. It's been around for years in the espionage community, where various spy agencies for different entities would effectively exfiltrate certain encrypted information and then over many years attempt to decrypt and then eventually would find something useful. But like in those sort of scenarios as well, a lot of the data that would be the subject of the steal now, decrypt later attack won't actually be valuable to a potential hacker in 10 to 15 years' time. However, there still could be, as part of the data that's exfiltrated now, certain very sensitive information that could still have some value. So, for example, things like sensitive information that might be collected about customers as a result of due diligence before granting loans or issuing insurance, that might turn up issues in terms of addiction problems or serious health issues, which at a later point in time could be somewhat challenging and sensitive and clearly potentially embarrassing.
So what can we do about this risk? Can it be minimized at all?
Well, the National Institute of Science and Technology in the United States, or perhaps better known to many in the community as NIST, has been working on new encryption standards that are intended to be quantum safe. And they've been doing this or working on this project since 2016. NIST is planning to finalize that process and publish these post-quantum cryptographic standards that can be used for commercial products by this year, although we're still waiting for standards to be finalized, and this hasn't stopped the likes of Apple and Signal developing their own post-quantum cryptographic protocols in the meantime to secure their own messaging functions. Another way we could secure communications is through a technology known as quantum key distribution, which relies on the properties of qubits to establish secure connections. And a key advantage of post-quantum cryptography, though, is that it can be operated on our current internet infrastructure, whereas quantum key distribution relies on a whole new set of infrastructure. So for that reason, organisations like the Australian Signals Directorate currently prefer post-quantum cryptography over quantum key distribution technologies as a means of securing communications in a post-quantum world. But the ASD has signalled that it will keep monitoring the developments of quantum key distribution technologies, as you'd obviously expect. But even then, moving over to post-quantum encryption systems is still likely to take considerable time and resources, you know, particularly for large financial services entities, given the complexity and multiplicity of their information systems.
Thanks, Peter. So it seems quite clear then that despite the enormous opportunities which quantum computing presents, it does pose some operational and security risks as well. What are some of the legal issues arising from quantum computing?
Thanks, Nayan. It's important to note at this stage that this is really a nascent area and it's going to continue to evolve. But there are a couple of key legal points that we probably want to highlight. So companies are generally obliged under the Australian Privacy Act to take reasonable steps to protect personal information that they hold from unauthorised access or disclosure. So it's reasonable in the future our regulators might see the adoption of post-quantum cryptography as necessary to comply with that requirement, although it's not clear when, as we've discussed earlier. Another interesting legal issue is whether or not the stealing of the encrypted information that Peter spoke about before can be used at some point later down the track, being decrypted using quantum computers, and whether that could be a data breach which has to be notified under the Privacy Act. A similar question arises in relation to cybersecurity incidents under the Security of Critical Infrastructure legislation and information security incidents under CPS 234, which would apply to a number of financial service operators. Now, these aren't bright line tests, and it will always depend on the type of data in question and the perception of risk. So as we often find ourselves in the context of emerging technology, in the absence of clear regulation, guidance from regulators on these issues will really play a big role in getting a clear understanding of what the obligations are and what the expectations are for companies.
Thanks, Susanna. More specifically for APRA-regulated entities, there are also key security and operational requirements under various prudential standards that would be affected by quantum computing. So APRA Prudential Standard CPS 234 sets out some baseline obligations for APRA-regulated entities in relation to information security. It requires regulated entities to maintain security capabilities which are commensurate with the size and extent of threats to their information assets and to enable continued sound operation of that entity. It also requires adequate security controls to be put in place to protect information assets. CPS 220 provides additional requirements in relation to the management of risks by APRA-regulated institutions, which include setting up risk management frameworks to handle risks, which include operational, insurance, and investment risks. The recently finalised CPS 230 also includes specific obligations relating to the effective management of operational risks, which includes legal risks, technology risks, and data risks. That includes the development of internal controls and business continuity plan to manage those operational risks. Recently, APRA has identified technology risks as a strategic priority, with the regulator warning the industry to tread carefully, conduct due diligence, put appropriate monitoring in place, test the board's risk appetite, and ensure that there is also adequate board oversight. Entities which are not regulated by APRA but hold an Australian Financial Services licence are required to, among other requirements, establish and maintain adequate risk management systems and to do all things necessary to ensure the financial services provided by the licensee are provided efficiently, honestly, and fairly. In the 2022 case of ASIC and RI Advice Group, the Federal Court held that these obligations extended to the effective management of cybersecurity risks and cyber resilience, it was the first time an Australian court held that an AFS licensee had failed to have adequate risk management systems in place in order to manage its cybersecurity risks. So as quantum computing continues to develop, it's likely that any controls or policies that financial services entities have in place will need to take into account the threats of quantum computing to remain compliant with the prudential standards and financial services laws generally.
Thanks, Angelica. So it's pretty clear that there's a broad range of regulatory obligations that could be impacted by quantum computing. How are other jurisdictions regulating this issue?
Probably the jurisdiction that is at the moment the most advanced is the United States, which has been making some important moves in this space in terms of the regulatory environment. In 2022, the Quantum Computing Cybersecurity Preparedness Act, a pretty lengthy term if ever there was one, was passed by Congress with bipartisan support. This act requires US federal agencies to annually take inventory of their IT systems that are or may be vulnerable to quantum computing and to develop plans to upgrade their systems to post-quantum cryptography once it's been standardized by NIST. At this stage, the US hasn't set any timeline on by when that migration needs to occur. They also haven't imposed any migration requirements on private companies yet, but it's likely that federal agencies affected by the quantum law would pass on these migration requirements to any service providers in their supply chain. So in effect, at the very least, I'd expect there to be indirect regulation through those third-party suppliers. At the moment, there aren't any other jurisdictions which have imposed similar obligations like those in the US, but it's certainly conceivable that governments and legislatures around the world might follow the lead that the US has taken as the risk becomes more tangible, and to also remain, frankly, in alignment with the United States, either with respect to similar legislation or with potentially softer requirements like guidelines, codes, and similar.
So what are some of the steps that companies can be taking now to assess the risk of quantum computing to them?
Well, Nan, we've heard that regulators around the world have, you know, some regulators have issued helpful guidelines on what companies can be doing now while post-quantum encryption standards are still being finalised. So one of the first steps for companies in Australia, for example, is to take inventory of sensitive data sets and encryption systems that are being used to determine, you know, which ones would be vulnerable to quantum computing. This would include identifying third-party suppliers that provide systems or services which involve the handling of sensitive information or systems. So fairly broad, but this would help understand the scope of potential vulnerabilities and to figure out what will be needed to focus on any potential migration in the future. So while there's a general sense that the widespread quantum computing sort of adoption is still a fair way off, as we've seen with other sort of waves of emerging tech, from a risk management perspective, that's only going to hold true until it suddenly doesn't. So having an idea of, you know, what the potential vulnerabilities are within an organisation over the next couple of years will set businesses up for success, I think.
I think that's a really important point, Susanna, which is the good old-fashioned everything fine until it isn't fine.
Exactly.
And I think just if we look then, what does that mean for organisations in the financial services sector? Well, I think you can kind of take a little bit of a cue from some of the prudential standards, which Angelica has already mentioned, and certainly the approach that regulators in this country and others are probably taking, which clearly seems to indicate that organisations should be taking steps to prioritise those systems which are going to be first for migration. And then, of course, prioritisation should be based on, in large part, some of the vulnerabilities associated with those systems and the types of data that those systems are effectively protecting. Based on those efforts, organisations would then be working on a plan to migrate once your post-quantum encryption standards are available. That plan ideally would be holistic, include testing of new standards, renegotiating third-party supply agreements as required, and decommissioning old vulnerable systems. All of which sounds incredibly easy to say, but of course is incredibly difficult in practice for anyone who has gone through any form of minor regulatory uplift process would also attend, and indeed, this would not necessarily be a minor uplift process. So All of this will be a very resource intensive process, particularly for large institutions like trading, retail banks and similar. So it is something that financial services companies need to start thinking about, if not today, then certainly in the very short term.
Thanks very much, Peter, Susanna and Angelica. That's all we have time for today. Thanks for joining us.
You have been listening to a podcast brought to you by Herbert Smith Freehills. For more episodes, please go to our channel on iTunes, Spotify or SoundCloud. And visit our website, herbertsmithfreehills.com, for more insights relevant to your business.